Zigeuner Lieder by Brahms, performed by the Europa Choral Academy, conducted by Yuzhard Daus. And that's it for this week's edition of Sunday Morning. I'm so glad you could join me. Next week from 10, I've musicians who have more than one string to their bows, a conducting composer, a piano-playing violinist, and a hardline musical modernist toying with a Neapolitan song. Not his usual line of business, I promise you. So, for that and a good deal more, do join me same time, 9 o'clock, next Sunday morning.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
D.R. Thorpe has written acclaimed biographies of Selwyn Lloyd, Alec Douglas-Hume, Anthony Eden, and most recently Supermac, The Life of Harold Macmillan. This is an engrossing and revealing read. Macmillan's life has several aspects to it that are, well, rather unexpected, really. There are, I suppose, some of the characters surrounding him were even salacious.
His life really spanned so much of the time when I was growing up, and of course he was the Prime Minister that I remember, you know, when I was at school. But he touched life in so many different ways, and you know, he was an absolutely fascinating character who, to my great surprise, you know, was quite happy to help me with my very first book in 1975, and then later with Selwyn Lloyd, you know, to sit and chat. And I think this is one of the strange things about the kind of biographical world, that all these people one was writing about, they drop them a line and they always come and have a chat, and they were all very pleased to do so.
You've clearly followed a line which is very helpful through conservative leaders. Have you ever been tempted to look on the other side of the fence, or do you like specialising in this area?
I'd always liked to have done a life of Harold Wilson, because coming from Huddersfield, he was a figure who loomed large. But there was some, you know, Philip Zeiler did the official life and Ben Pimlott did a wonderful life. So in a way that was secured. And so it was just a strange way that, you know, things develop, that, you know, I began with Austen Chamberlain and Curzon and Rab Butler in that book about the uncrowned prime ministers. And then I was invited to do Selwyn Lloyd's life. And then Alec Douglas-Hume, who helped me on that, invited me to do his life. And then Clarissa Raven invited me to do Anthony Eden's life. So the thing kind of progressed.
Well, I'm sure a letter from Number 10 will be on your doorstep fairly soon from David Cameron. yeah. Richard, reading the Macmillan, I was fascinated to see and delighted to see how your love of music creeps in and we'll talk about that later. Yes. But you mentioned Huddersfield just now, and in fact, I suppose that does inform your first choice.
Yes, the whole North Country choral tradition of those local societies performing those oratorios, you know, Judas Maccabeus and Elijah in those four square Victorian town halls. I mean, that was very much part of my musical upbringing.
Do you think that in some way that choral tradition was a way for a lot of people in that part of the world to sort of feel a spirit of survival in difficult times, that it was a bringing together? It was after all, television was not so prevalent then. It brought people together to do something where they had to listen to each other and make music.
I think that's very true. I think it was a great sense of community. I think it happened in South Wales too. But certainly the whole kind of family of the Huddersfield Choral Society, you know, it went on from generation to generation. And a cousin of mine sings in the first extract that we're going to hear shortly.
Which is?
Well, what does one choose? And in the end, I thought Elgar and the end of part one of The Dream, in which, you know, Elgar himself said, "This, if anything of mine, is worth your memory." And he was right.
Thank you.
Go forth upon thy journey, Christian soul. From The Dream of Gerontius by Elgar, we heard John Cameron with the Huddersfield Choral Society, the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and Choir, conducted by Sir Malcolm Sargent. That is very much an oratorio, that piece, but we get perhaps the closest glimpse we ever get of what Elgar might have been had he been an operatic composer.
Yes, I mean, at the time it was said that it was Parsifal in English, which I think is a good description of The Dream.
Yes, one thinks of Amfortas and the yes. wound, and there's very much that sensibility to the music.
Very much so.
Which brings us nicely, I think, Richard, on to Vaughan Williams, because your list has a very strong English feel to it, which is partly to do with your life so far.
I think the Vaughan Williams C Symphony, the extract we're going to hear shortly, in a way it follows on, I think, from both Parsifal and The Dream, that there's the orchestration, there's a lot of similarities. But the key difference is that it's essentially secular, and that I think Walt Whitman's poetry was very, very attractive to composers of that time. I mean, think of Delius's Sea Drift, in that, A, it was free verse which could fit into any kind of musical pattern. And then, secondly, it had this kind of pantheism, this celebration of the glory of the world all around us. I mean, the kind of thing one gets in the final movement of Mahler's Song of the Earth, about the wonderful earth all around us. And we get this in this extract from the C Symphony.
But just to fill in what I was saying there, because you taught for quite a long time, didn't you, at Charterhouse?
Yes, and Vaughan Williams was very much a kind of great presence there. And then after his death, Ursula Vaughan Williams, his widow, was a frequent visitor and a great benefactor of the school. In fact, the last time I met her, she was really thrilled in that it was the summer of 97, and she said that she persuaded Scholte to take the Ninth Symphony into his repertoire in the autumn, which she believed was the last great unremarked masterpiece of Vaughan Williams. And sadly, Scholte died in September of that year, and it never happened.
You told me about the rather wonderful remark Vaughan Williams made when asked about his Fourth Symphony and whether it was anticipating the horrors of war. And he had a rather wonderful reply.
Yes, this was one of the last occasions that Vaughan Williams came to the school. One of the masters inquired this, you know, is this a premonition, this dissonant, violent symphony about the war to come? And Vaughan Williams replied, oh, not at all. I was just very exercised about the Dorking bypass.
However, this music that we hear now does certainly plumb depths slightly more profound than the Dorking bypass.
Very much so. Thank you.
O vast rondeur swimming in space, part of the last movement of Vaughan Williams' A Sea Symphony. The London Philharmonic Orchestra and choir with Cantilena, conducted by Bernard Haitink. There is a quality there. You know, we always hear, don't we, the opening of the Sea Symphony as being a very famous...
Famous opening.
Famous opening, and it is indeed wonderful. But there is something profoundly celestial and spiritual about that last movement.
I mean, rejoicing in the beauty of the natural world all around, and yet underneath, I think, there's the melancholy of a feeling that it's all transient and eventually will pass away.
Which is Mahlerian.
Yes, the Song of the Earth, yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the period that you've written a lot about, Richard Thorpe, and indeed which occupied both the composers we've just heard, Elgar Vaughan Williams, and in particular the one we're about to hear, was the subject of war, in the First World War,
yes,
and the profound effect that that had on a whole generation, which now it's almost hard to imagine if you weren't actually living in that time.
Yes, I mean, Napoleon once said that to understand a man properly, you had to know what was going on in the world when he was 20. Well, on his 20th birthday, Anthony Eden won the Military Cross at the end of a terrible week in which he'd seen hundreds of his comrades mown down alongside him. And the same thing is true, of course, of Harold Macmillan. I mean, he lay pretending to be dead in a trench because otherwise he'd just have been blasted out by the soldiers coming through. And neither Eden or Macmillan ever shed, as it were, that the memory of what the Great War did. And the Great War kind of hung, as it were, over the whole of the 20th century. It was the thing which was never, never forgotten. And it must have been just, you know, unbearable to... I mean, how could somebody come through all that?
And as an example of the talents that were extinguished, which we know nothing about, we do at least have some... that we have something to remember them by, and Butterworth is certainly...
Yes, because George Butterworth, I mean, people know of Vaughan Williams' great friendship with Holst, but I think his friendship with Butterworth is often under-regarded. And although Butterworth didn't compose during the war, I mean, his main writing was 1910 to 1914, he became, in a way, the kind of musical equivalent of Rupert Brooke, and that the piece we're about to hear is in fact a kind of musical epitaph for the whole of that horror of the Great War. I mean, it's based upon his song from the Houseman cycle about loveliest of trees. In a way, Butterworth, it's very poignant even before the Great War, but once one knows what happened to Butterworth, he won the MC twice, the second time on the morning of his death at the age of 31. And he became, in a way, like Houseman's lines, the lads that will die in their glory and never be old.
part of A Shropshire Lad by George Butterworth. That was the opening. We heard the Halle Orchestra, conducted by Sir Mark Elder, who clearly has got Butterworth under the skin, I think.
Very much so, yes. And Gerald Finzi was very impressed by the Rhapsody, and he said, it sums up our countryside as very little else has ever done. But, of course, after Butterworth's death, it sums up many other things as well.
I wonder so much, especially there's another piece that I think is a masterpiece, which is There Is a Willow Grows Aslant Abroad.
Hamlet, yes.
And when you hear that, I often wonder, what would this man have written if he had survived?
Mm. He persuaded Vaughan Williams really to move on to an orchestral symphony after the Sea Symphony. And, of course, this was the London Symphony. And Vaughan Williams posthumously dedicated the London Symphony to Butterworth's memory, which is very appropriate.
One of the fascinating things reading Supermac, Richard, was that, well, apart from the fact that you make the point that when Vaughan Williams was writing about peace, it was actually war that was sort of forming Macmillan. That's one point. And then there were the quite extraordinary things that were going on in his private life later, the relationship of his wife with Bob Boothby, which must have been incredibly painful.
I mean, in 1930, he had a breakdown at that time. And the interesting thing is it was touch and go whether he in fact retired from public life at all. And in the end, his solicitor, Philip Freer, said to him that he mustn't get divorced, whatever he did, because that would rule out any chance of him being Prime Minister. Now, for somebody in 1930, when Macmillan was a rebellious backbencher, to be saying, well, you mustn't spoil your opportunity to becoming Prime Minister, it was a very far-seeing remark. In fact, his mother earlier was very worried that he might turn Catholic because she believed that would disqualify him from being Prime Minister. And that was when he was 15 and at Eton. So there were people who felt from an early stage that he would have an opportunity of becoming Prime Minister later. But then, of course, so much of it is luck, how the cards fall and break out.
And in fact, what one discovers is that slightly stiff moustachioed upper lip revealed a world of turmoil inside, which is very interesting.
This was the outside kind of carapace to the world. But underneath the surface, it was, kind of turmoil. Mm. Of course, the thing that really made Macmillan was becoming minister resident in North Africa during the Second World War, when for the first time he had real executive responsibility. And when he left Italy at the end of the war to join Churchill's caretaker government, Field Marshal Alexander, his great friend, was there to see him off at the airport. And Macmillan said to him at the airport, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had it to do all over again? And Alexander said, well, I don't think so, Harold. We might not be so lucky the second time.
Now, Richard Thorpe, just in case people think that you are Anglophile to the exclusion of all else, we are now going to what I think is the white-hot opera of Richard Strauss.
Yes. I mean, Rosenkavalier and recently Capriccio, very much admired. But when one actually gets down to it, I mean, Salome and Electra, those great one-act pieces. I mean, Salome was about lust, but Electra was about revenge. And the core of this opera is really the famous recognition aria when Orestes comes back after all these years of exile. And I think the other thing about this is that, of course, going and learning one's opera in the 1960s and 70s at Covent Garden, it was Scholte. And the whole kind of world of things that Scholte did, and people like Nielsen. I mean, Nielsen and Scholte nights were very, very special. And I sometimes think of all the masterful recordings they made. They're one of Elektra. I mean, despite the wonders of their recordings of the Ring operas, I mean, the Elektra was just very, very special.
And the muscularity that he brought to the conducting, which was not macho, but because it was so musical, but it propelled the music with such ferocious energy.
And people also, I think, mistakenly think, oh, well, Strauss is just a lot of violent noise. But when Elektra has finally kind of recovered from the shock of seeing her brother again after all these years of exile, it becomes almost chamber-like delicacy. And all the great Mahler commentators, Norman Del Mar and William Mann, they pick on this as just being one of the supreme moments in all Strauss's output. In fact, one of the supreme moments, I think, in all opera.
Hey!
It really is dangerous, that music, isn't it?
Yes, and the emotional core of the whole kind of potent drama, as they have this moment of repose before the great revenge upon Clytemnestra.
We heard Birgit Nilsson singing Orest, Orest from Electra by Richard Strauss with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir George Shorty. And there was just a moment of Tom Krause as Orest. I suppose, Richard, it's not a long journey to Wagner from there.
No.
Why have you chosen what you have?
Of course, the thing about choosing Wagner for a programme like this is what does one choose? And in the end, it has to be concise. But even then, the passage that we're about to hear is arguably one of the great moments, again, in all Wagner. And, of course, it's Walter's prize song from Meistersinger. And I think the interesting thing about this is that it is a kind of standalone kind of piece that can be sung by a tenor as a piece in a recital. But it is really the resolution of 3 to 4 hours of drama where everything comes together in this piece. And you know, Pogner drops the rules because here is a man with something new that goes beyond the rules. Beckmesser is defeated, and it just is very special.
It's rather a fascinating conundrum, I think, speaking as a composer who's written an opera about a composer. Mm. If you set yourself the task of writing something in the opera which has got to be kind of beat everything else around it, you're setting yourself quite a... especially if you've already written, you know, music as Wagner has done, which is very fine. So you've then got to come up with something which tops all that.
Yes, and the prize song certainly does.
Schön.
Wonderfully sung there by Jonas Kaufmann.
And I think the interesting thing is that he'd made a great impression as Max in Der Freischütz. And I think traditionally, singers who sing Max in Der Freischütz then move on to Walter. And one can only wait for his first Walter in London.
The prize song from Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg, Act 3, by Wagner. And we heard the Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Marco Armiliato. The swirling textures in Strauss and Wagner are such a different sensibility from the sound world of Benjamin Britten. Mm-hmm. And here, of course, was a composer who was producing music when you were young and who even sang, I think.
Yes, that one was always in the choir until one's voice broke. That was the kind of pattern of school life in the 50s. And I'll never forget, singing in St. Nicholas. I mean, I just felt this was just a revelation. And then, of course, all these great works came out. The Nocturne in 1958, Midsummer Night's Dream, the War Requiem, obviously, in 62, the Cello Symphony, which was actually premiered in Moscow on my 21st birthday, and I was very keen to hear it soon afterwards. And then all these great works... right through to Death in Venice. And I was very lucky to be at Covent Garden on the night that Death in Venice was first performed in October 73 after the premiere at Alba in the summer. And Britten was in the box and he wasn't really spotted. And at the end of the piece, Piers, who'd been singing for 3 hours at Aschenbach, came to the front and indicated Britten in the box. And it was just one of the most moving moments one could imagine, that here was the man who had produced this as a kind of culminating, valedictory piece.
It's not Death in Venice that you've chosen, though.
No. I mean, again, there's so many pieces one could choose. Mm. In fact, it's another valedictory piece.
As, of course, here he was saying goodbye to a sort of slightly Rambo-esque world, as he perhaps had lived it in America, returning to England.
Yes, that Départ that we're about to hear, which concludes Les Illuminations, it's obviously the Rambo poetry has this sense of departure and farewell. But the cycle really is, the culmination of the first period of Britten's composing career. And I think it marks this kind of leaving of America with all its bohemianism and disorder and returning to his native Suffolk, where he was to compose Grimes. And it was interesting that when the work first was performed, one of the early reviewers said, in a rather two-edged comment, "Oh, for a touch of clumsiness somewhere." And this was a kind of the criticism that it was all technically so efficient. But actually, you've only got to listen to this to hear the real emotion there is underneath it.
And especially in this performance.
This Ian Bostridge performance. I mean, if you choose a piece of choral music or vocal music by Britten, or anything, you put Piers in. But, I mean, Bostridge here, I mean, I think it even excels the nuances of Piers in the Illumination recording. It's an intensely moving piece, and particularly in that performance. And I think it really looks at the predicament of the exile and the exile coming back from somewhere that hasn't worked out as he felt, and he's returning to the native Suffolk.
Départ from Les Illuminations, Opus 18, words by Rambo, music by Benjamin Britten. And we heard a haunting performance there by Ian Bostridge with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. Richard Thorpe, you are going to come to the apotheosis of this programme, if you like, with what for me is the apotheosis of symphonic form.
The Sibelius Seventh Symphony, the ending of which we're shortly to hear. We began with something from the first symphony of one of the great 20th century symphonic cycles, and we're to end with the final movement of another of the great symphonic cycles, Sibelius's. And Vaughan Williams, we come back to him, he was so impressed by the Sibelius Seventh Symphony, and when he'd heard it, he wrote to him and he said, "You have lit a candle in the world of music that will never go out." And hearing this piece, it's interesting because when you think of, you know, let's say the Mahler and the Bruckner and the expansive symphonies, and even, you know, some of Sibelius's earlier ones, particularly the second, do you get this great concision of form where it's kind of a single movement of some just 20 minutes, and yet so much is compressed into it. I mean, largely through the changes of tempo within the short time span.
It's as though four movements of a symphony are compressed like a telescope which you push back into its inner shell, and yet you can see through it with huge clarity.
Yes. I mean, I think the really sad thing is it makes one think of, well, if only the Eighth Symphony hadn't ended up in the bonfire at Einola, his house north of Helsinki. If only we'd had an Eighth Symphony, what could it have been? But in a way, could anything cap this?
Thank you.
And to think that apart from Tapiola, the next 33 years of his life were virtually silent. Very, very odd.
A wonderful piece. I have some reservations about the Carrie Anne tempi of the ending there. I would like that stretched out. That last note on the violins go beep.
Yes.
When it resolves.
Yes.
It seems slightly sudden on that one, but I'm used to other recordings. Mm. That's the trouble, isn't it, with listening to music. You get to know a recording and it becomes your kind of template.
Template, yes. I think that's true of many of the Ring operas, despite all the great things later. I mean, one goes back to the Schulte one.
We heard the conclusion of the Symphony No. 7 in C, Opus 105, and it is that C that the violins lead to from the B by Sibelius, with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Well, thank you very much, Richard Thorpe. Can we expect another volume from you in the next...
Oh, things are underway, yes.
You don't want to say what it is.
Not really at the moment, no, but things are underway.
Glad to hear it. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it immensely.
D.R. Thorpe talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the actor Brian Blessed. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. Welcome along to Radio 3 if you've just joined us. In a moment, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Yes, a philosopher, yes, a writer, but he was also a composer with several operas to his name, and he earned his living from time to time working in the music business, as you'll hear in a couple of minutes' time in today's edition of the Early Music Show. That's after a summary of the news this lunchtime, the time being 1 o'clock. It's read by Lopa Katari.
Thousands of Egyptians have gathered in Tahrir Square in the capital, Cairo, to hear the outcome of the country's first contested presidential election. Unofficial figures have suggested that the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi, won a narrow victory over his rival, the former Prime Minister and retired Air Force Commander Ahmed Shafiq. Both candidates have claimed victory. The Prime Minister has called for a debate on the welfare system, saying the current system of housing benefit sends out the signal that people are better off not working. David Cameron says housing benefit for the under-25s costs a fortune, nearly £2 billion a year. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, the Liberal Democrat, Danny Alexander, says he believes the right thing to do is to let the current welfare reforms bed in before further decisions are taken. Turkey has sent an official message to Syria, setting out a diplomatic protest at Syria's shooting down of a Turkish aircraft on Friday. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said Britain will support Turkey if it demands the right of the United Nations to take robust action against its neighbour. Tony Blair has said the crisis in the Eurozone is now so deep that a grand plan is required to rescue it. The former Prime Minister said Germany would have to accept that the debts of all the countries were shared, and in return they would have to spell out their plans for economic change. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, has dismissed David Cameron's Big Society as a ploy to conceal what he called a deeply damaging withdrawal of the state from its responsibilities to the most vulnerable. Dr. Williams, who will stand down in December, calls the idea aspirational waffle in a new book. And finally, the weather. Sunny spells and scattered showers across the country will be most frequent and heavy in Scotland, northern England and East Anglia, with a chance of a few thunderstorms. The showers will become more isolated elsewhere, with most areas becoming dry into the late afternoon. And that's the latest BBC News and weather. The time is 2 minutes past one.
Lopper, thank you very much indeed. We're off to Bregenz in Austria for our Sunday concert this week. The BBC Philharmonic plays Shostakovich and Mahler, the first of Shostakovich's cello concertos and Mahler's Fifth Symphony. That's our Sunday concert in an hour from now at two. But next, this lunchtime, it's time for today's Early Music Show. Here's Catherine Bott.
Hello. In today's programme, I'm taking a look at the life and work of an 18th century philosopher whose writings influenced the French Revolution. Perhaps his most famous maxim is, "Man is born free, but everywhere he is in chains." You're probably ahead of me already. I'm talking about Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And he's the subject of today's Early Music Show, partly because he was born 300 years ago, on the 28th of June, 1712, but mainly because he wrote music of sundry kinds, including seven operas. He made a significant contribution to contemporary thinking on music theory, and played his part in a famous musical squabble that could only have arisen in the partisan world of opera, the Querelle des Bouffons. and although he's well remembered now for his philosophical works, he spent much of his life wanting to be known as a poet and composer. Scene from the intermezzo Le Devin du Village, The Village Soothsayer, by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Country girl Colette fears that she has been betrayed by Colin the shepherd as he pursues a sophisticated lady, and the village wise man sees no reason to disabuse her. The singers on that recording were Gabriella Bürgler and Dominique Werner, with Cantus Firmus consort directed by Andreas Reitzer. You'll have gathered from my introduction that Rousseau was a man of many parts, but in today's programme I'm sticking to his musical life. One tends to think of him as French, but he was actually Swiss-born. His mother was the daughter of a Calvinist preacher, and his father a well-educated watchmaker. Rousseau's early musical education wasn't really up to much. He had singing and recorder lessons, but when it came to composition, he was largely self-taught, mainly from reading and annotating a treatise on harmony by Rameau. He ran away in his mid-teens, not just from a divided family, but from Switzerland, ending up in neighbouring Savoy. A Catholic priest gave him shelter and introduced the Protestant teenager Rousseau to Françoise Louise de Varennes, a noblewoman in her late 20s who was a professional lay proselytiser for Catholicism. An intoxicating mix, Rousseau was ripe for conversion, among other things, and was sent to a seminary in Turin. Most of what's known about Rousseau's early life can be read in the several volumes of his posthumously published Confessions. Here's what he has to say about the older woman who seems to have been the love of his life. "I went to the seminary with about the same spirits as if they had been taking me to execution. What a melancholy abode, especially for one who left the house of a pretty woman." Among the talents she had cultivated, music was not forgotten, She had a tolerable good voice, sang agreeably, and played on the harpsichord. She had taken the pains to give me some lessons in singing. 8 or 10 interrupted lessons did not teach me half the notes. Notwithstanding, I had such a passion for the art that I determined to exercise myself alone. The book I took was not of the most easy kind. It was the Cantatas of Clérambault. It may be conceived with what attention and perseverance I studied when I inform my reader that without knowing anything of transposition or quantity, I contrived to sing with tolerable correctness.